face shields no longer mandatory in open areas in the Philippines. President Duterte defends government's decision to purchase face masks from China instead of local manufacturers. Authorities describe as a success the first week of implementation of the new COVID-19 alert level system in Metro Manila. And later on in the program, we'll speak to the authors of an article focusing on the secrets and lies of the Marcos family during the late dictator's reign. Hi, I'm Carmina Constantino. Dateline Philippines begins right now. Thanks for joining us. For those of you watching us on YouTube and on Facebook, nice to have you with us today. Topping the midday news, the Philippines drops its face shield mandate, but that's only for open areas. President Rodrigo Duterte said face shields should still be worn indoors and in crowded areas.
I was informed that the technical advisory group on the medical experts on the use of face shields pwede na tanggalin sa labas. No more face shields outside. Ang limitasyon, ang face shields gamitin mo, 3 C's. 3 C. S with S, 3 C's. Closed, whatever facility, hospital, o basta magkadikit-dikit, crowded, ganun rin. It's a crowded room, tapos close lahat, mas delikado, at saka ang close contact kung magkadikit-dikit ang tao. So dyan, applicable pa rin ang face shield.
Back in June, President Duterte said face shields should only be required inside hospitals, but he immediately retracted that statement after the highly infectious Delta COVID-19 variant was detected in the country. Metro Manila showing positive signs after a week under the new COVID-19 alert level system. MMDA Chairman Benhur Abalos says from a peak of 40,000 active cases a week ago, that number has dropped to 35,000.
Very, very encouraging data. Pero manipis lang po ito, ha? Baka mamaya mag-enjoy tayo masyado. It goes without saying, importante pa rin ang granular lockdowns, importante ang minimum health protocol dahil we must learn to live with the virus.
Under this new alert level system, specific COVID-19 hotspots are placed under lockdown. On Wednesday, the Philippines tallied 15,592 infections. But again, the health department notes that the relatively fewer cases is due to lower laboratory output. The Octa Research Group also saying the new alert level system has been effective so far. Octa fellow Dr. Guido David, says the COVID-19 reproduction rate in Metro Manila has dropped to less than 1. He notes surrounding provinces and other areas like Cebu City and Davao are also seeing lower reproduction rates.
Siyempre, gusto natin linawin na nagsisimula pa lang yung pagbaba ng bilang ng kaso. May kataasan pa rin yung bilang ng kaso, kaya kailangan pa rin patuloy pa rin yung pagsunod natin sa mga health protocols. At may mga regions rin na sa Region 2 na nagsisimula pa lang or tumataas pa lang yung bilang ng kaso.
The Philippines moving closer to vaccinating children against COVID-19. Vaccine Chief Carlito Galvez Jr. said that could happen by mid-October as more vaccines arrive in the country. Over 1 million doses of Pfizer's jabs were the latest to arrive in Manila. Galvez adds the inoculation of the general public could start by November.
May timing naman po eh, mid of October. Tama-tama po yun na meron na po tayo talagang sinasabi naman ng mga eksperto na pagka meron na tayong sapat na bakuna. At nakita po namin, Mr. President, on the logistics perspective, hindi po tayo mawala ng bakuna. So yung programming po namin, Mr. President, before election, dapat protektado na po lahat ang
The U.S. promises to buy 500 million more COVID-19 vaccine doses to donate to other countries as it comes under increasing pressure to share its supplies with the rest of the world. President Joe Biden made that announcement during a virtual summit aimed at boosting global vaccination rates and rallying world leaders to do more. Deliveries for this new tranche of donations will begin next year.
And it brings our total commitment of donated vaccines to over 1.1 billion vaccines to be donated. Put another way, for every one shot we've administered to date in America, we have now committed to do three shots to the rest of the world. Nothing is more urgent than all of us working together to defeat COVID-19.
Japan is also doubling its COVID-19 vaccine donation to 60 million doses. The Asian superpower has already provided about 23 million doses, mostly to Asian nations like Taiwan, Vietnam, and Indonesia. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration authorizes a third dose of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for those aged 65 and above. The American agency will also amend Pfizer's emergency use authorization to allow booster shots for high-risk individuals. These include health workers and employees who are constantly exposed to the virus. The agency says booster doses should be administered at least 6 months after the completion of the second jab. Back here at home, President Rodrigo Duterte continues to defend government's allegedly anomalous pandemic spending. He insists the usual procurement laws were waived due to the Bayanihan to Heal as One Act. President Duterte also explained why government chose to source face masks from China rather than from local manufacturers.
May supply talaga ang China ng mask. Because they use it every day. Ganon ang practice nila. Kaya kasi ang tanong ninyo, baka minadali, manufacture ka agad-agad para mahabol doon sa bidding. Meron ng stock ang China. Kasi halos lahat ng tao doon nagbibili dahil nga sa pollution.
The Food and Drug Administration also defended the Department of Budget's purchase of nearly 400,000 COVID-19 test kits that were dangerously near their expiration date.
Nung panahon na yon, lahat po ng test kit ay 6 months lamang po ang shelf life ng mga commercially available RT-PCR test kits. So hindi lang po sa DOH yun, lahat po ng private laboratory, lahat po ng RT-PCR laboratory, ang nabibiling test kit po nun ay 6 months lamang po ang shelf life.
President Duterte continues his verbal assault on Senate Blue Ribbon Committee Chairman Richard Gordon. This time, President Duterte threatened to file malversation charges against the senator. Duterte claims Gordon misused 140 million pesos in public funds while he was still the chairman of the Subic Bay Metropolitan Authority.
So I would like to inquire from the ombudsman if there is a case filed against you because lahat na disallow and the money was not returned, the money was not used in the right way, it reduces into something like a personal liability mo. Kindly settle or not, I will personally see to it that a case will be filed against you.
President Duterte also accused Senator Gordon of diverting his congressional funds to the Philippine Red Cross, where he serves as chairman. But Gordon says this was still allowed back in 2010.
Patunayan niya kung binubulsa ko, wala akong binubulsa. Napatunayan na ng DSWD na liquidate na yan. Ang problema niya, binubulsa ba ni Lau yung maraming pera na binigay?
In other news, Dr. Willie Ong believes it is the perfect time for him to seek the vice presidency. Ong is the running mate of presidential aspirant Manila Mayor Isko Moreno. Ong says the country needs a doctor who can address issues regarding COVID-19 vaccine supply and the well-being of medical frontliners. He also responded to concerns over his ability to take over the reins in Malacañang should the president be deemed unfit for office.
Isko is younger than me. He's 11 years. He's healthier than me. I think that's quite impossible. And just in case, I'm always ready. Sa tulong ng Diyos, magagawa natin lahat. Diba? Madali lang yun.
Okay.
Pag nandyan na, wala tayong choice, gagawin natin. I don't force anyone or ask anyone to vote for me. I'll just do my best. Gagawin ko lahat para matulungan kayo. I have weaknesses. I have anxiety. I have nervousness, but I'm doing my best. It keeps me humble. It keeps me grounded. If I cannot do it, if there's a problem, I will be honest with you.
Meanwhile, a political analyst believes the window for a one-on-one showdown between the administration and the opposition may be closing soon. Professor Julio Tihanqui says he already sees a five-way race for the presidency.
There will be an administration candidate and there will be an opposition candidate. No? But as things are moving right now, it seems that having a one-on-one between an administration and a unified opposition candidate seems to be slipping away. No? But, of course, there's still some possibility. No? So the window of opportunity for that would be October. No? And negotiations, I believe, would still be ongoing for these candidates to find a unified opposition candidate.
Professor Tihanqui also thinks Manila Mayor Isko Moreno may be the black swan candidate in the 2022 presidential race.
But unlike the other declared candidates so far, Isko Moreno has the advantage of not only having a compelling rags-to-riches narrative, but he also, in a short period of time, has a proof of concept. No? That is, in the short period of time that he was mayor of the capital of the nation, Manila, he was able to deliver. Manila, being the center of political and economic power in the country, is really a showcase, no, of what a public official can or cannot do.
After a failed attempt at a Senate seat back in 2019, Bayamuna Chairman Nery Colmenares will make another run at the upper chamber next year. The former congressman admits his party is still hounded by the same problems, primarily a lack of resources. But he asserts there is a need for more opposition lawmakers in government.
Tatlong termino ako ng Kongreso, hindi ako nagnakaw dyan, hindi ako nagpayaman dyan. Kaya I can always criticize them face to face because wala silang skeletons on my closet. That's, and probably there is also a need for another senator to do that in the Senate. So I really hope that the people will this time choose somebody from Makabayan and say, wala namang kayong pera, pero hindi kayo nang, kasi hindi kayo nang urakot. Wala namang kayong, palagi kayong nasa oposisyon kasi hindi kayo papareho ng ibang kongresista o senador na kung sino ang presidente, lilipat kayo doon.
We're going to take a break now. Up ahead, we'll speak to the writers of an article focusing on the secrets of the Marcos family amid attempts at historical revisionism. You're watching Dateline Philippines here on ANC. Stay with us. are back. You're still with Dateline Philippines here on ANC. Here's another look at our headlines this noon. Face shields no longer mandatory in open areas in the Philippines. President Duterte defends government's decision to purchase face masks from China instead of local manufacturers. And authorities describe as a success the first week of implementation of the new COVID-19 alert level system in Metro Manila. Back with more news, the Commission on Elections meets with Philippine lawmakers as calls to extend the voter registration period mount. The poll body has argued an extension will cause delays on its election calendar, but lawmakers seem bent on extending the deadline to October 31st from September 30. Long lines can still be seen outside registration centers with authorities trying to implement minimum health standards amid the pandemic.
Ang problema po kasi natin dito ay meron tayong schedule of activities. At yung schedule of activities na yan ay nakadepende sa pagtatapos ng voter registration on September 30. Yan ang magiging basihan para sa pagdetermina kung ilang balota ang iimprenta natin, kung gaano kalalaki ang mga presinto, at kung ilang presinto magkakaroon ng batas tungkol dyan, kailangan sundin. So gagawa natin ang paraan kung sakali.
On Wednesday, the Senate passed on second reading the bill on the extension of voter registration. A similar measure has been filed at the lower house. Moving on, there is no way to, or there are so many ways, no one way to tell the stories or the horrors of the late dictator Ferdinand Marcos's dark reign. Vera Files found another path to put flesh into history, now being assaulted by revisionism, by focusing on a silent witness to the rise of the fallen president. Their piece, Ferdy and Meldy's House of Love, Lies, and Loot, appears on ABS-CBN's news site. The people behind the story now joins us here on the program, Miguel Paulo Reyes and Joel Arriate Jr. Thanks for being with us today. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us, Carmina.
All right, let me begin with this question. I'm going to go with Miguel first. Why is the house on Ortega, now Mariano Marcos Street, sort of a fitting vehicle to tell an important aspect of the Marcos story?
It was still is an important location for the Marcoses. It was, as you mentioned, it was a silent witness to their rise to power. As we said in our article, he purchased the house in 1950. At the time, he was still a newly elected congressman. It's his first year as a congressman. And he stayed there until they moved to Malacañang in 1965. And it has served as their campaign headquarters ever since.
I'm going to go to Joel now. Joel, in the piece, you speak of how the house was witness to the rise of the fallen dictator, but it was also, in the beginning, sort of a prison for the former first lady, where she couldn't find peace. Tell us more about that period in the couple's lives.
The sources for that particular episode in Ferdinand and Imelda's lives were actually close associates, in fact, relatives even, of Imelda, of Imelda Marcos, for example, Beatriz Romualdez Francia, who's a niece. And then, of course, the biographies given by Karima Pulutan and others. So this is not an attempt to humanize what they've been through, but to explain, actually, why the persistence to gain power that became therapeutic for them, actually. From that very confined space that they were just trying to navigate their married life, the political context of what they're in, the ambition of Ferdinand, really all became a factor in that, because Imelda even had mental health issues in those days that, according to biographers and close confidants, she was able to navigate successfully by accepting the ambition and her role in pursuing that ambition. So it all started in the house in San Juan.
I love it that in the article there was a line there where you said this was the house, in so many words, where she practiced on being a queen.
Yes, because one of the sources, quoting Ninius Menia, saw Imelda doing exactly that, how to behave as a royalty. Because though the Romualdises, Imelda's family, have been a prominent part of the Philippine political scene since the American period, Imelda and his specific branch of family were, in a way, provincials that went into Manila and became part of the Marcos scheme to forward himself to reach the presidency. In fact, so Marcos was rather persistent. He demanded from Imelda to act, to have that royal bearing, actually, to be able to show himself, herself, among the Manila elite, that she and Imelda are part of the ruling class, of the ruling elite at the time.
But as Joel there mentioned, Miguel, that wasn't so in the beginning. In fact, she sort of felt as an outsider in that house in the beginning, because there was a previous occupant. Tell us more about that.
It has long been rumored and substantiated, we think, with the sources that we looked into, that there was an original Mrs. Marcos, or she was styled as a Mrs. Marcos. This is the, she was Carmen Ortega, another beauty queen. I think we didn't mention it in the article, but we found mention of details matching those of Carmen Ortega in one of Ferdinand Marcos's authorized biographies, actually. A 1967 biography written by Benjamin Gray, Rendezvous with Destiny, I think was the title. Although she was not named, but the details included there matched later retellings that did name who she was.
So in the beginning, she wasn't really comfortable in that place. It wasn't a source of happiness until, in the article you mentioned, money started to come in, and that was sort of the source of happiness. The jewelry started to come in, and that was when she would really find joy. I love the part when it was very descriptive of how she would show the jewelry to some visitors and share her happiness as she would look at the jewelry. When did this become apparent in their history as a couple residing in that house on Ortega Street? Joel, let me go to you for that question.
I think that's the time when Marcos became a senator, in fact, Senate president. So he has much clout. But before that, being a member of Congress, Marcos already, as mentioned by some sources, he was trading favors on certain legislative measures for sackfuls of money. And as we mentioned in the article, eventually, Imelda tired of those. She was tired of counting money, so it progressed to jewels and jewelry and having queenly pretensions.
What was it about this article, Miguel, that was sort of the easiest thing to write? What was the easiest part in putting together this piece?
Personally, I found writing about the ill-gotten wealth the easiest, mostly because the sources are a bit readily accessible to us. I think we mentioned that how the courts later on determined what is ill-gotten wealth. And we also had access to previous studies showing that how they accumulated that wealth.
Yeah. And yet, Miguel, the revisionism that has become rampant in recent months, how do you explain that disconnect? It was easy for you, as Miguel said. Let me go to Joel now. As Miguel said, it was easy. The trail was there. The materials were readily available.
And yet, the constant assault on history, the constant attempt to revise it. Explain to us the disconnect there.
Joel. Because the Marcoses, since they came back to the country in the early 1990s, actually made a very clever attempt in propaganda. It was not an assault. It was not revisionism per se. There were feel-good events in Ilocos Norte. There was the Marcos Day, the Marcos Fiesta, and later on there's a historical trail on the Marcos's legacy in Ilocos Norte. It became a touristic affair to that degree. But that's only one strand. And of course, they invested, and this is documented by investigative reports, they invested significantly on online propaganda, on manufacturing really attention-grabbing, feel-good pieces of information, if we meant disinformation even. So that's the difficulty, because if you're talking about martial law, there's the tendency to look at the pain, the heart that the people suffered. The Marcoses are offering another thing, the glory days, the feel-good aspect of the particular time. The, as we've said, the good, the true, and the beautiful aspect of it, which were in fact perfected during their regime. So they were just, in a way, rehashing, repackaging previous propaganda. And these are, of course, during the martial law years, propaganda that went unchallenged because there's no free press. ABS-CBN, for one, was locked up. Nobody was querying, challenging the assertions or the ridiculous stories, outright lies by the Marcoses. Mm-hmm. So this went on and they repackaged it and now we're having it again. Mm.
What makes you think, Miguel, what makes you think that they've become masters at this? As Joel pointed out, they sort of just picked up from where they left off.
When they returned to the Philippines, they were welcomed, if I recall correctly. They had their loyalists ready to welcome them back, to help them return to, settle back in and return to Malacanang. And they've been repeating, as Joel said, repeating propaganda that they've been purveying since the Marcos regime. This is propaganda that has been absorbed as Bible truth by a lot of their supporters. Probably partly through sheer repetition, I suppose, in various forms. Initially, before, you had print, television, radio, and now the latest incarnation, social media.
And back to the house. That house was a witness to the beginnings of it all, to the genesis of this master plan that they had. Let me ask you, though, it's become a silent witness to all of these events in their lives and also in their dark reign. Why is it that the house is still there and it hasn't been sequestered by government? Joel, let me go to you for that.
I think Miguel would have the details since he's the one who examined actually the papers.
All right, go ahead.
It was never sequestered because it was purchased in 1950, well before Marcos became president, well before the declaration of martial law, well before what has been determined as the start of their scheme to acquire ill-gotten wealth. So it has never been sequestered, but it has been subject to possible foreclosure to satisfy judgment against the Marcoses. But so far, it's that judgment has, let's say, escaped execution. So it hasn't been taken from them officially, I would say.
I want to go to the evidence room now. Of course, we want our viewers to go on to the site later on after this program to read the very compelling piece. What can you tell us about the evidence room in that house? Who between the two of you can tell me more about it? Joel?
Miguel,
I suppose I will. Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
This is as we mentioned in the article, it probably even before 1998, that it became, people knew about it in 1998 because of the Inquirer series, of interviews with Imelda, that was published in December of that year. The interviewer, Cristina Herrera, mentioned that they were setting up, I think it was the old Asianmer office, with papers showing evidence of their innocence. And that room has frequently been shown to other interviewers since. A lot of people have interviewed Imelda, and we watched, I'd like to think we watched most of them. That are still accessible online, or and she would show this room. She would show evidence that was supposedly shown during her trial in New York, where she was found acquitted, but that acquittal was due to Ferdinand Marcos being the principal plaintiff. Which, as some jurists later on said, if it was Ferdinand Marcos who was on trial, he would have been found guilty. She would show this room. She would show these certificates of supposed assets amounting to hundreds of billions, which are incredible. But by showing these, she's trying to show that their wealth is legitimate. It's from legitimate sources, supposedly from gold trading that Marcos has been engaged in since the 50s.
Now, a while ago, you guys said that they've become masters at this. It wasn't really, you wouldn't really call it revisionism, but it was sort of a creeping PR plan for them. You mentioned about, you know, it having a touristic theme to it. And we can see that now it's happening again. Of course, we're talking about this house as being part of a historical trail in the city of San Juan. First of all, Joel, what do you make of that? That right now you're seeing a repeat of it, not in Ilocos Norte. We're talking about the city of San Juan.
Yes, because Marcos, the Marcoses, they have allies. I mean, the execution of their propaganda, the execution of insisting on their version of history, however fictitious some of the details were, are being undertaken for them by people which were part of the Marcos regime. So the Zamoras, for example, everybody knew, the father served as part of the president's office then. And so there's that long relationship between the Zamora and the Marcoses. So these are actually, it's happening in some parts, I'd not say all over the Philippines, but there are sympathizers, local officials that are sympathetic or would like to put forward the Marcoses as part of their own political agenda. So there's a rogue statues, for example, in Camiling, Tarlac, that at the one end, you'd have Ferdinand Marcos, and the other end, you'd have Ninoy Aquino. So it's playing both sides, the safest way. So there's that. And just to go back to the issue of evidence that earlier discussed by Miguel, they also have, in 2004, issued a compendium of that, a digest, to say. It's called Let the Marcos Truth Prevail, and it was distributed to almost all state colleges and universities all over the country. And then, not satisfied with that, they even reissued a much thicker volume later on. And the launch of these books were attended, well attended, by political personalities that have benefited definitely from the plunderous regime.
When that house opens its doors to the public, this question goes to both of you. Let's have Miguel say his answer first, and then we go to Joel. When this house opens its doors to the public, what should be in the people's minds as they walk through the halls of this house? How should they take it all in? From what perspective? Miguel.
Be skeptical. because I think some of the materials that are being readied for exhibition, actually I'm not even sure, I think it is already publicly accessible. Some of them were taken from Batac, Ilocos Norte, where they have several museums, as far as I can tell. And they would only show the true, the good, and the beautiful as the Marcoses believe they are. It doesn't show the complete picture. It's a typical, you would say, something that hagiographic in a way. It's something that doesn't show their negative aspects at all, which is what you would expect from propaganda like that. So be skeptical.
Okay, Yael saying be skeptical. What about you, Joel? What should the people bear in mind as they walk the halls of their house?
I think they should have a critical engagement with it, that it's a proof in history of theft, of how preserved political power, of how plunder in their previous regime have sustained this particular edifice, that it's not and should not be taken as something, as a piece of nostalgia.
Well, the piece is called Ferdy and Meldy's House of Love, Lice, and Loot. It appears on abs-cbn.com or news.abs-cbn.com. Very compelling read. I'd like to thank you, Miguel Paulo Reyes and Joel Arriate Jr. for joining us today. I should say that this is part of a series, correct, that you guys are working on?
Yes, because here at the Third World Study Center in UP Diliman, we have the Marcos Regime Research Group, and I think the 23rd or the 24th article that we've written via Vera Files that have been syndicated from time to time by ABS-CBN and other news outlets. So we're working on a book, actually.
All right. Looking forward to reading, going through the pages of that book. Thank you again, gentlemen, for joining us today. Take care, you guys. You keep safe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Miguel Paulo Reyes and Joel F. Arriate Jr. joining us here on the program. Again, the piece, Ferdy and Meldy's House of Love, Lice, and Loot, appears on news.abs-cbn.com. Read it. We're going to take a break now. Still ahead, the World Health Organization sounds the alarm over the health impact of even the smallest amount of air pollution. Dateline Philippines will be right back. Stay with us here on ANC. News, the World Health Organization issues its first air quality guidelines in over 15 years as it aims to save millions of lives from air pollution. The UN agency says there's clear evidence of the damage inflicted by air pollution on human health at even lower concentrations than previously observed. In an address to its 194 member states, the WHO slashed the recommended maximum levels for key air pollutants. This includes particulate matter and nitrogen dioxide, both of which are found in fossil fuel emissions.
Because of air pollution, the simple act of breathing contributes to 7 million deaths a year. Almost everyone around the world is exposed to unhealthy levels of air pollution. Inhaling dirty air increases the risk of respiratory diseases like pneumonia, asthma, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and increases the risk of severe COVID-19. It's also a major cause of other non-communicable diseases like ischemic heart disease, stroke, and cancers.
Greenpeace Philippines calls on government to hold large fossil fuel companies and cement firms accountable for their share in causing the global climate crisis. Country Director Lea Guerrero says this is a way for the Philippines to take leadership when it comes to addressing environmental problems. Greenpeace has already tapped the Commission on Human Rights to look at possible human rights violations these companies may have caused. At his UN General Assembly speech, President Duterte said the Philippines is committed to getting rid of 75% of its greenhouse gas emissions by year 2030.
Siguro, in the first place, it was great to see President Duterte calling for urgent climate action at the UNGA on the basis of climate justice. Urgent climate action is really imperative, but we think that the Philippines can do more.
In business, experts urge the Philippines to quickly ratify the Regional Comprehensive Economic Cooperation, or RCEP, Free Trade Agreement. The Philippine Institute for Development Studies says the country cannot be the last economy to ratify the deal, since it may miss out on huge benefits. Based on estimates, the local economy is seen getting a 0.84% boost from RCEP by 2030, with exports growing by $406 million. The Trade Department says Malacañang has already ratified the trade pact and is now awaiting action from the Senate. RCEP is scheduled to be fully implemented next year. It's a massive free trade deal headed by the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, which accounts for 28% of global GDP. The U.S. Federal Reserve keeps its interest rates near zero, but it hinted at hiking rates next year and reducing its monthly bond purchases even sooner as the business environment in the U.S. snaps back from pandemic shock.
There's a range of perspectives. I guess my own view would be that the test, the substantial further progress test for employment, is all but met. While we have interesting signs that in many ways the labor market's very tight, we also have lots of slack in the labor market, and we think that those imbalances will sort themselves out.
June Neri of BPI believes the Philippine Central Bank should also start thinking about curtailing massive stimulus amid sustained elevated inflation. The BSP will announce its latest policy decision this afternoon.
I think central banks have remained or must remain a little bit cautious on their policy. You know, they cannot be stepping on the accelerator all the time. They have to try to ease off the accelerator a little bit. You know? They don't have to put the brakes immediately. But the question is, how accommodative should accommodative be? You know? Must interest rates be so negative, like in the Philippines, minus 3%, no? Or is 2% enough, minus 2% enough?
Actor Tom Hanks hails a new museum dedicated to filmmaking in Los Angeles. The museum was spearheaded by the Academy of Motion Pictures and Arts and Sciences, the organization that hands out the Oscars. Among the exhibits are movie memorabilia. It includes a pair of red slippers from The Wizard of Oz and an R2-D2 model from Star Wars. The museum also addresses controversies in the industry, such as on-screen diversity and the Me Too movement. The museum will open to the public September 30th.
This museum has really got to be the Parthenon of such places. Do we need a movie museum? Because we need to celebrate everything that this town has brought to the world and everything art form has brought to the world in order to bring people together.
And that'll do it for today. Thank you for joining us. I'm Carmina Constantino. If you want to revisit today's episode, Dateline Philippines podcast is on Spotify and Apple Podcast. Play back this newscast too on ANC's YouTube channel and on ANC 24/7 on Facebook. Keep safe. Keep it here on ANC.